So love, huh?
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, we're talking about the story Love by William Maxwell. What do you expect from such a short story with such a title, Love? It's not about familial or romantic love. It isn't about a friendship either, not really. This is a story about a teacher. Sure, the narrator seems to have been infatuated with the teacher, Miss Vera Brown, when he was in the fifth grade, and his nostalgic recollection of her classroom imbues her with a kind of saintliness. She was angelic in his telling. And then something happens, and the boy must learn a difficult lesson about what ends up happening when we have love, give love, are loved. In our discussion, Peter Orner and I also make mention of Charles Baxter and his ideas of what he calls the half-known world. This is the way we come to know characters in stories, only half-known. And it's enough. It's necessary. This is how we know our teachers. They stand before us, fully who they are as teachers, but who they really are and what they do outside of the classroom is not known to us. And the mysteries inherent in the relationship we have with our teachers takes on even more significance in a story like this one by the great William Maxwell. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss Love by William Maxwell. I love this story. I can see how some people might not like the story, but there are actually, I mean, superficially, it can be a little tidy, but I also think it's so complicated when you're dealing with a character who's nostalgic about the past, glorifying the past, and glorifying a past where he was obviously so innocent, stuck in that mode of that innocence, but then learns a very difficult lesson ultimately that is so far away from the idea of love or the endurance of love.
I'm so glad that you suggested this one, because I think when I've read the story in the past, it has sort of washed over me. And I find that embarrassing. How could I have not sort of stopped at this one? I always try to employ the no superlative, but we break it every time. But I think it has one of the great endings of any story that I can recall. And it's not because it's surprising or weird, or, well, I guess it's weird. I don't know. I think everything, the whole story, and I've said this before too, so I feel embarrassed. It was sort of miraculous that he knew it was the ending, you know?
Yeah.
And he says in the beautiful preface of All the Days and Nights, he says that after he wrote Love, which is so interesting, that he thought he knew how to do this. He was sure that he thought that stories would come easier. And of course, that was wrong, because this was lightning in a bottle. This was, you know, I think maybe you only get one or two of these in your life, and this was it. He got it on the first try, and he thought, okay, and, you know, from now on, I'm going to be able to write a story with an ending like that every time. And his stories are gorgeous, and there's so many great ones. But the ending of this one, damn. I think people might ask, like, what do you mean? Why is this ending so extraordinary? And I would struggle to explain it.
But that is so the point. We should not have to explain it. We should not have to explain it. We should just be able to say that is a fantastic ending. But, you know, the thing about this story, too, is that it's about a teacher. And he's hearkening back to the fifth grade and recalling this teacher. And I, you know, always think about this idea of teachers and teacher stories. And I borrow this idea from Charles Baxter about the half-known world and how teachers are figures for us who are half-known. In our childhood, we kind of know this sort of implicitly. We just kind of know that we are in this half-known space. We don't know what the other kids' houses look like necessarily, or what their parents are really like, or where the teacher lives, or what her kitchen looks like, or what she's, you know, there is this kind of half-known thing that I find so compelling in teacher stories, and it makes me think back to childhood, and about my teachers and about how one of the reasons that they were such exalted figures for me was because I didn't know the whole story. And I think in that question mark, in those gaps and in that mystery, you know, it's better if we don't know. That's the allure. That's what makes them so interesting. And I remember the teacher crushes that I had, like very clearly this narrator had on Miss Vera Brown. And then because it's so, to use your word, the superlatives, because it is so hyperbolic in terms of the children's impression of her, and he's speaking for all the children, then, for me, that's a red flag. I'm sort of like, it couldn't have been that perfect. Where is the fly in the ointment? Where is the problem going to be? We glorify the past when the future dries up. And I think about this kind of impression that he's been carrying around of Miss Vera Brown. We do that when we're young and innocent, and these people seem very alluring to us and interesting. And we do it when we're older and nostalgic about the past. And we remember, oh, she was a great teacher, or he was such a good teacher. That's one of the things about this story that for me makes it so multidimensional and complicated. It's not a simple story about a narrator remembering a teacher from his boyhood and then something happens to her in the end. All of these characters are so complicated, and they are in situations that are complicated, but in the telling seem very simple. Our childhoods are not simple times. They are not. And anyway.
This is what? 1, 2, 3. It's a 3.5 page story. And it's getting all of what you're saying. You know, this sort of, I love this idea of, the unknowability of these figures. You know, and it's always weird to see your teacher out, you know. and we're both teachers. We've all been on the other side of that. You know, where they see us in a different context, wearing something different, or, you know, arguing with our spouse, whatever it is, you know, like that, all these things can happen, and they're like, oh, right, you know, a person, right? And I think, you know, Miss Vera Brown is, you know, etched into a kind of, what the story doesn't do is make her out to be someone she's not. The mythology remains. She gets sick. It's a beloved teacher. What grade are we?
Fifth grade.
We meant to have her for our teacher forever. We intended to pass right through 6th, 7th, and 8th grades and on to high school, taking her with us. Like, you know? And I mean, my son is so attached to his current third grade teachers. I see this wonderful teacher that he has and kind of how he does navigate the fact that he's still beloved by the grades above him. It's always a tough one, right? When you go back to your teacher from that you really loved from last year or the year before.
Yeah.
Even they've moved on and you've moved on, but still you're clinging to that. And so that's what he's saying here. We intended to pass right up through 6. He doesn't want to do that. They're not even going to go through that process. They're going to bring her with, as if that's possible. And on to high school, taking her with us. But that isn't what happened. One day there was a substitute teacher, and then, you know, the story catapults from there. She's absent, and it turns out that she's ill. In the fall, we passed on into the 6th grade, and she was still not back. And then I love this line. Benny Irish's mother found out that she was living with an aunt and uncle on a farm a mile or so beyond the edge of town. So one afternoon, Benny and the narrator get on their bikes and they go out to see her. It's at the place where the road turned off to the cemetery and the Chautauqua grounds, a red barn with a huge circus poster on it showing the entire grounds. In the summertime, riding in the back seat of my father's open Chalmers, I used to crane my neck as we passed that turn, hoping to see every last tiger and flying trapeze artist. But it was never possible. The poster was weather-beaten now with loose strips of paper hanging down. Such a gorgeous detail, and one I missed when I read the story this morning.
But, you know, you say something so interesting about the mythology. There is mythology that we create as children about our teachers or about something that happened in school or about what we know about the next grade that we're anticipating and kind of fearful about. There is mythology. The thing is, this is fifth grade, and I was thinking about how this probably happened to Maxwell in the fifth grade, something like it. But fifth grade is such an interesting grade. You know, it's right before sort of like this middle school, you know, sort of sensibility. It's almost like the last outpost of grammar school. And what he does with the idea of love, like you'd see that word in the middle of the space, the title, and he starts with her name, Miss Vera Brown, and says the name might as well have been graven in stone, and you know her handwriting is flawless. As she called the roll, her voice was as gentle as the expression in her beautiful dark brown eyes. She reminded me of pansies. When she called on Alban Ahearns to recite, and he said, "I know, but I can't say." The class snickered, but she said, "Try," encouragingly, and waited to be sure that he didn't know the answer, and then said to one of the hands waving in the air, "Tell Alvin what 1/5 of 3/8 is." If we arrived late to school, red-faced and out of breath and bursting with the excuse we had thought up on the way, before we could speak, she said, "I'm sure you couldn't help it. Close the door, please, and take your seat." If she kept us after school, it was not to scold us, but to help us pass the hard part. Then the thing about the apple, somebody leaves an apple on her desk, and she puts it out of sight. And I always think about, she puts it out of sight in case some of the children are hungry and they're looking at that apple. They leave flowers for her, and she puts them in the water of her drinking glass. Like, come on. She's amazing. She never had to ask us to be quiet or to stop throwing erasers. We would not have dreamed of doing anything that would displease her. Then they find out when her birthday is, and they buy her flowers, and they take her to the movies. You know, he's really, these are the hits. These are the big important things that he remembers. And then the part that you read, "We meant for her to be our teacher forever." The way he builds her up from the very beginning of the story, then all of us are in love with her. We get it. We understand. And then we sort of start to take apart the narrative a little bit and start to think about the whole idea of hindsight and nostalgia. And it doesn't take away from the beauty of the memory, whether it happened or not, or how is he, you know, sort of coloring the memory. It's still lovely and it's still worth remembering. And he is recalling her in a very specific way. And when the substitute comes into the picture, then we have a shift. He is describing the place. And, you know, as we're going on this little journey through the story, as readers, we're sort of in his own childhood, I think. He's going into a darker, less idyllic space. In the classroom, everything seems to be working out so well. And as he's learning this very hard lesson, starting to learn this very hard lesson about life, I love how he's on his bike, he's on this journey, and it is not a beautiful space.
And then the story happens.
Yes.
You know? And, you know, it just seems to me that there's always this choice a story writer has, how to make a scene memorable. You know, is it less, is it more? And what ends up happening is he knocks on the door of the farmhouse where this young teacher, and let's not forget, she's 23 years old and she's ill. We don't know what ill with what yet. We'll find out. But, you know, she's very, very sick. And these boys, these sixth grade boys, want to go see their teacher. They knock on the door. We hadn't thought ahead to what it would be like to see her. We wouldn't have been surprised if she'd come to the door herself and thrown up her hands in astonishment when she saw who it was. But instead, a much older woman opened the door and said, "What do you want?" And it's absolutely startling. And it very much relates to the choice that he makes, that you know, again, this sort of like cosmic, miraculous to me, choice he makes as a writer to end the story with this same woman.
Yeah.
He seen before.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, we came to see Miss Brown. I said, "Winter class at school," Benny explained. I could see that the woman was trying to decide whether she should tell us to go away, but she said, "I'll find out if she wants to see you," and left us standing on the porch for what seemed like a long time. Then she appeared again and said, "You can come in now." And they do come in, and he remembers some beautiful details about what was in the house, an old-fashioned organ, like you see in country churches, the linoleum, stiff, uncomfortable chairs, portraits in curved glass, in big oval frames. Wright Morris has some beautiful photographs of those kinds of portraits in curved glass and big oval frames. Maxwell was, it's not really relevant, but Maxwell was, among so many other people, he was Wright Morris's editor. We were talking earlier about editing briefly. Maxwell was, the legendary editor. And, for so many years, I think people certainly knew that he was a writer, but it didn't really take hold until when, I don't know, late in his life, I think, that people realized that the editor was the one, that he could very much write and surpass the greats that he worked with, like even Welty, who he loved, and others, lesser lights than Welty. Cheever, for example. Is Cheever a lesser light than Welty? I don't know. Anyway, back to the story, though. The scene that I was saying, so there's one amazing scene at the door, but then the scene where they see her. Now, it's what? Seven lines? It's over.
Yes. Do you want to read that paragraph that starts "The Room Beyond"?
Sure. "The room beyond, it was lighted by a coal lamp, but seemed ever so much darker than the unlighted room we had just passed through. Propped up on pillows in a big double bed was our teacher, but so changed. Her arms were like sticks, and all the life in her seemed concentrated in her eyes, which had dark circles around them and were enormous. She managed a flicker of recognition, but I was struck dumb by the fact that she didn't seem glad to see us. She didn't belong to us anymore. She belonged to her illness." Now, is extraordinary, and this is a great paragraph. I might take out the last two sentences just personally. "I was struck dumb by the fact that she didn't seem glad to see us. Benny said, 'I hope you will get soon.' So anyway, too late to edit. Maybe Maxwell, that was pretty, pretty, who do I think I am? But I'm not sure I needed those two sentences. But anyway, the fact that he doesn't linger in that room. I mean, there's an entire novel in that room, but he does it with, just the fact that her entire life seemed concentrated in her eyes. And you can just, you see these boys like, oh my God,
Yeah.
She doesn't need to tell us that.
I think about how, she's only 23, and it seems like the concentration of her life has been as a teacher, at least from his point of view. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And this idea of she didn't belong to us anymore. I mean, I feel like they're not just going to the sixth grade. They're going way beyond, she's not our teacher anymore. She's not. It's just, to me, it's kind of an interesting line. And Benny says, "I hope you get well soon." And my impression, my assumption is that the narrator didn't say anything, or at least nothing that he's sharing with us at this point. But then this part, "The angel who watches over little boys who know, but they can't say it, saw to it that we didn't touch anything. And in a minute, we were outside on our bicycles, riding through the dusk toward the turn in the road and town." That line, "little boys who know, but they can't say it," is an echo of the Alvin who doesn't know the answer and says, "I know, but I can't say. I know, but I can't say." So Alvin says, "I know, but I can't say. I know the answer, but I can't say the answer." Whether he knows the answer or not, who knows? But then he takes that line, that idea, "the angel who watches over little boys who know, but they can't say." And I'm just stuck on this. "I know, but I can't say." I mean, I think that these are words that maybe in one way or another, we're probably sort of living through all the time. I know, but I can't say. The way stories help us understand something that we know, but we can't say it, but the story is saying it for us. I don't know. There's just that, the angel who watches over little boys who know, but they can't say it, as an echo of what came before. It never fails to just knock me over. And then they get on their bikes and they go out of the darkness, back on the road, back into town, back to resume living with another teacher and leaving Miss Vera Brown behind. And then, of course, the next paragraph has to be, a few weeks later, I read in the Lincoln Evening Courier that Miss Vera Brown, who taught the fifth grade in Central School, had died of tuberculosis, aged 23 years and 7 months. And then a space. And then another very interesting setting, another very interesting space. Sometimes I went with my mother when she put flowers on the graves of my grandparents. The cinder roads wound through the cemetery in ways she understood and I didn't. And I would read the names on the monuments: Brower, Cadwallader, Andrews, Bates, Mitchell. In loving memory of, infant daughter of, beloved wife of. The cemetery was so large, and so many people were buried there, it would have taken a long time to locate a particular grave if you didn't know where it was already. But I know, the way I sometimes know what is in wrapped packages. I'm going to stop there, because I didn't mean to read that far, but the cemetery and the litany of names, and how the mother knows where to go, but he doesn't know where to go yet, but he will. The mother knows exactly where to go. I cannot tell you how true and real and resonant that is. I've been in those cemeteries. I'm with my dad. We're in my dad's truck, and we're going into the cemetery to go to my grandfather's grave. And my dad just is turning here, turning there. And if I had to, for $1 million, find my way there the next day, I would not be able to. You know, there's just something about a cemetery which is such a labyrinth. And for a kid who's maybe not paying attention to that, I don't know. I just, sorry to be taken with something so small and seemingly like just incidental, but it's so good.
It's enormous, those names and the way that, you know, like you said, he doesn't know how to get there, but he will. And those cinder paths, you know, in the cemetery. I want to go back to the line that you were focusing on earlier, though, because I puzzled over it this morning and I couldn't figure it out. The angels, I knew it was getting at something. And it wasn't until you said it's echoing the kid who couldn't answer the question that I realized what was going on. But I was such an amazing, you know, that's it, you know? And I wonder, like, when he was writing it, if it was deliberate or not, you know?
Yeah.
The angel who watches over little boys who know, but they can't say it. Like you said, right there, that's almost enough. But the sentence goes on, saw to it that we didn't touch anything. And there's the kind of, I don't know, you know, like, it wasn't Vera, it wasn't the teacher who tells them not to touch anything. It was this angel. John Updike, and I think I probably ranted about this in the last Maxwell episode we did, and it's not even a rant, and he was not even wrong, because he's right, but Updike said something to the effect of Maxwell was the kindest of writers, and that's certainly true, you know. I always thought there was a little tinge of kind of, not a diss exactly. I think Updike certainly respected Maxwell, probably loved him very much. I mean, I'm sure that Maxwell edited a lot of Updike, but it almost seemed like a little bit like a slight, you know, kind of, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's something, you know, and I feel like, you know, because Updike isn't the kindest of writers, and he, I don't know that he valued that on the page. But he recognized that it was the source, I think, of Maxwell's great power. And it's not that he's always so kind. I mean, right. That's just, you know, but for the most part, even the characters that have, you know, done horrible things get a sort of humanity, as any great writer would do. But Maxwell really, you know, I think of, you know, the murderer in So Long, See You Tomorrow, you know, you understand, mm-hmm. and you feel for him. Mm-hmm. You do. Anyway, the point here, I don't even know what the point is, but who is this angel? I just was so curious, you know, and is it because they shouldn't touch anything because they get sick?
When you just kind of know, maybe as a kid, that the person in front of you is on her deathbed, I don't know how to say this. For a kid, there must be angels waiting for the person to die. You know, it's sort of like that she's surrounded by angels who are here to take her to heaven, right? That kind of thing. It's such an observation, or it's such a statement from the narrator sort of channeling the little boy in that room, who's probably so scared and so anxious and so nervous, and because of that doesn't touch anything, but he attributes it to this other power, you know, that he thinks is in that space. It is so interesting for Maxwell, I think, to include this thing about the angel, but I do, of course, it's channeling the child's point of view. It's the child's point of view at that point. That's how I think some children think about death, because they've been told the angels will come for you and take you to heaven, you know. Right. So I don't know if you want to read the last part and then we can...
Well, maybe we shouldn't, but making this grand point about the ending, and I don't even know what I'd say about it except is holy shit. Yeah. And I can understand. I will read what he says in the preface, which is that when he wrote this story, when I wrote Love, love came right the first time without a word having to be changed. And I thought mistakenly that I had had a breakthrough and stories would be easier to write from that moment on. All I needed to do was just say it. And, you know, yeah, that works. And it's like giving somebody advice about writing. It's meaningless. Even giving yourself advice is meaningless. But he knew. And I think that's a skill in itself, or like a, you know, a lucky thing in itself, that he knew that this one he should not touch. Even that awkward line that we've been focusing on, which is awkward. The prose is awkward.
Yes.
You know, the angel who watches over little boys who know but they can't say it saw to it that we didn't touch anything. That is not Maxwell's most elegant sentence. But as you point out, it might actually kind of be his most beautiful in some awkward way. Anyway, it's just amazing. So I can see him thinking, okay, I got it. Next one's kind of, all I got to do is just do it, you know? And a lot of his stories approach this beauty for sure, but there's something about this particular ending that I would just argue is one of the ones that doesn't come very often, even for a writer, you know, as great as this one.
I love that, you know, I can imagine Miss Brown saying, what is the answer, Alvin? And he says, I know, but I can't say. And all the children in the class snickered. The class snickered.
And he didn't know. That's the thing, but, right?
But he didn't know. No, he didn't know. But the children laugh because they know that he doesn't know. And it's such a silly thing to say. I mean, I know, but I can't say. But what he says is so meaningful. I mean, for an adult about life. I know, but I can't say. I mean, to me, coming across these lines the two times again, in my most recent rereadings is I get, as we say all the time, like we come to the story a very sort of different person, or we receive it very differently depending on when we read it. I don't have the words. I mean, how many times has that happened lately? And it's not because I can't remember the words. I have words. I just cannot articulate it. It's too complicated. It's like trying to carry water in your hands across the room. You can't. The angel who watches over little boys who know, but they can't say it. I just feel like he has crossed a threshold, not to be too, you know, going into this house. He crossed a literal threshold, but he has crossed a threshold that has basically shown him a very hard truth about love, about life, about love. It dies. It ends. It does. People do. And the feelings can morph into something else. Like in recalling her, as you said, she's really mythologized. I mean, she's just this, she herself is an angel. But I just think that a story like this, and also something about, I don't want to call it audacity, but to call it love, to call a story love, I mean, how many people would turn to read this story just because of the title and get something very unexpected? But, you know, I think he learns a very hard thing about, and we know what happened, you know, in Maxwell's life. I mean, this is a person who had a lot of sorrow in his childhood. I don't know what I'm saying, except this story is so, this is not like, you know, reminiscing on Facebook with your childhood friends about, you know, Mr. So-and-so. It's like, this is hard. This is so difficult and complicated. And it's not about kid stuff. Yeah. But it does show you the complexity that is in childhood, the totally complex situations that we are in and characters that we butt up against and situations that will, you know, burn themselves into our memories forever and ever. And we will never forget how it feels to wend your way through a cemetery when you don't know exactly where you're going. I just think it's such I just think it's an amazing story.
And I think, and like I said, when you said it's when you, you know, it's always kind of when you return to it. I must have read this at a time when I just didn't get it, you know, that I, you know, and I'm always looking for the most compressed story in any book. And this is, I think, probably the shortest one in here. And it didn't quite land. And then this morning it hit me like a, you know, a freight train. And it was this ending. And I don't know if this ending, I think it does what you're saying in terms of bringing us to the complexities of childhood. I also think it brings it far beyond that to someone trying to recapture that and sort of understanding far more, or thinking they do, or trying to understand far more. You know, that's why I think just this ending, and again, by talking about it, I'm... you know, for myself, but so I'll just read it. As you said, the cemetery was so large and so many people were buried there, it would have taken a long time to locate a particular grave if you didn't know where it was already. But I know, the way I sometimes know what is wrapped in packages, that the elderly woman who let us in and who took care of Miss Brown during her last illness went to the cemetery regularly and poured the rancid water out of the tin receptacle that was sunk below the level of the grass at the foot of her grave and filled it with fresh water from a nearby faucet and arranged the flowers she had brought in such a way as to please the eye of the living and the closed eyes of the dead. But I know the way sometimes I know what is wrapped in packages is kind of mundane. oh, really? You can guess what's in the package. That's great. But it's like there's something almost like, I'm like, really? That's the metaphor right here? But you just know what's in the package. And what he knows, though, is what the aunt does, which that she'd gone and replaced regularly that rancid water. I'm trying to explain why it's so great. And that's the end of the story, that it ends on her and ends on that ritual that he knows in his blood. That seems to be, encapsulating, like he does know how to get around that cemetery now, you know. Anyway, I don't want to talk about it because I don't know why it's so good.
No, I think you're right. I do want to say something where he says, we hadn't thought ahead to what it would be like to see her. That's such a great line to me, because they're like, we know where she lives. And they get on their bikes. Let's go see her. And they think they're going to recapture something. We hadn't thought ahead to what it would be like to see her. We wouldn't have been surprised if she had come to the door herself and thrown up her hands in astonishment when she saw who it was. Like, he is so hopeful that he's going to recapture something if he can just get to her. And then the thing about let me tell you something about cemeteries. This is so perfect. Sometimes it's just like an empty metal aluminum can that you get at these places that set up near cemeteries where you can buy either real flowers or artificial flowers. And these receptacles that sink below the level of the grass, yes, and the water turns rusty and rancid and horrible, and you do dump it out right then and there, and you find the faucet and you fill it up and you do it again, and you arrange the flowers in such a way to please the eye of the living. And, this is so, for me, I'm not going to try to explain the ending, but I just feel like there's something there. He has never seen the aunt do this. He has never seen the aunt do this at the cemetery. He imagines it because he hopes that's what somebody would do for Miss Brown or anybody, you know?
Not that he hopes, that he knows.
Yeah, that he knows. This idea of, and it's something I think about a lot, this idea of who's going to go and tend, your grave, your headstone, brush the leaves away from the headstone and refill the coffee can with the wrapping paper around it. That's what they look like, these things sometimes. But, for him to sort of say, but I know, as you said, that the elderly woman who let us in, she did that for Miss Brown. Somebody had to do that for Miss Brown if they loved her. So it becomes less about how they loved her or how she made them feel loved a certain way. But it becomes important to him as an older person that somebody loved this 23-year-old, this teacher who died at 23, who maybe, because she's half-known, she's from this half-known space, maybe she was never loved. I don't know. I mean, or loved enough in this way. Like, where were her parents? We don't know.
I don't know. You're just trying to figure out. I mean, it doesn't, the story is the story, but then you, what it does in your minds, I think that's something we should show people.
But I know, but I can't say it,
You're right, exactly. So there you go. I want to say one shout out, though. It was a book published not long ago by Godin in Boston, and my friend Joshua Bodwell, who was the publisher at the time of Godin, he brought out this book of William Maxwell's called The Writer as Illusionist, Unpublished and Uncollected Work. And it's a beautiful book with all kinds of things of Maxwell that we haven't seen anywhere else. The essay that he wrote on turning 90 that appeared in New York Times Magazine, which I just remember very vividly reading, and prefaces and things that he wrote that were unpublished. And Alec Wilkinson writes the intro and has notes throughout the book. And he's also a wonderful writer in general, and also about Maxwell, who was his close friend and mentor. But this is a quote from one of his speech that he gave at University of Illinois in 1963. He says, in a collection of literary essays called The Art of Fiction, Mr. Somerset Maugham, you can almost tell he's going to say something mean if he is Mr. Somerset Maugham, who, by the way, I adore his stories, and we should do one.
Yes.
So
yeah.
While Maxwell's about to diss him, I wonder, why was he reading that book if he didn't like Maxwell, if he didn't like Maugham's work, right? But he says this, he says, Mr. Somerset Maugham says, God, fate, chance, whatever you like to call the mystery that governs men's lives, is a poor storyteller. And it is the business and the right of the novelist to correct the improbabilities of brute fact. And he says, and I don't know who he's talking, I don't know who George Holland is here. We'll have to figure it out. But this statement makes George Holland froth at the mouth. You know, I think George Holland is a character of his, but I'm not remembering. Anyway, later on in the speech, he says this, far from being a poor storyteller, life, looked at carefully, is full of exquisite detail, of plot, of suspense, of ideas, of architectural structure, of everything that goes to make a successful novel, that to do anything but to reproduce what happened to the best of one's ability is to be lacking in literary intelligence. Or so George Holland believes. This is an extreme position, of course. What he says when you back him into a corner is that the writer should know what cannot be improved upon, especially when it is handed to him on a platter. And so that's a little bit out of context, and we don't know who George Holland is. This is the key part. The writer should know what cannot be improved upon. That's it right there. The writer should know what cannot be improved upon, and I think he realized it here. And that's what he says it in a different way in the preface, that he thought when he recognized one story that did not need any improvements after he first did it, he thought he knew how to do this. And of course, you know, the next one was a lot harder.
William Maxwell is the author of Love. Find it in the book, All the Days and Nights, The Collected Stories. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. Jake Brazzotti composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.